Hey, it's Francis. You know, since we're all in on fall cooking again, it's time to get back to baking, too. Have a listen to this episode from last year featuring two amazing bakers. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So, you may have heard me make this confession before, but I'm really not much of a baker. Cooking I always got, because cooking seemed to be something that you can do on the fly, you know? You work on instinct, you add this, you taste it, you add more of that, and baking to me always seemed so technical or precise, or if I'm really honest, kind of boring, you know? You gotta add 2 cups of this, exactly 2 cups, you stir, you put it in the oven, you hope for the best. But the more I learned about the two, the more I realized, you know, that isn't entirely right. You know, the best cooking, of course, can be highly precise, and the best bakers are all about intuition and feeling. And, you know, not to get too woo-woo, but some of the most intuitive, like deep-feeling, emotionally astute people I know are bakers, or pastry chefs, or sweet makers, call them what you will. And today, we dig into the craft and art of baking and sweets making, and some of the emotional intelligence behind those people. Anissa Halu is a living legend of a cookbook author. She joins us later to talk about the profound traditions of sweets in the Middle East. And first, we spend some quality time with Lisa Donovan. So Lisa was for years one of the most respected restaurant pastry chefs in the South. She worked with great chefs who helped mold her along the way, but at her core, she's kind of a self-taught baker. And while she doesn't really talk about it this way, I think that's important, because so much of her new book, Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger, is about finding what's within you to stand up to a world that tries to hold you back. Anyway, we're delighted to have her in to talk about that book and for her to teach us a thing or six about baking. Hey, Lisa.
Hey, Francis. I'm really happy to be here with you.
Well, man, how do you feel? Congratulations. Your book just came out, Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger. I adore that title so much. I knew I would love the rest of it, too, but the title is just spectacular. But how do you feel? It's out now in the world for a couple weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been, you know, a ride. and it's a strange kind of time and space to be doing a book launch. But it's also, there are some bonuses to that. You know, it's nice to be doing this from home. So it's unlike anything I think most normal human beings experience. So kind of putting yourself out there with a memoir and then talking about it for 2 or 3 weeks straight is quite an endeavor. So I'm enjoying it, though. It's been really special.
Oh, good.
Yeah. It's been pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's remarkable about the book, well, a lot of things, but one of them is that, you know, it's a memoir, and I think it gets lumped into the category of food memoir. But to me, the food, it's not about food, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems like a story about a journey of a person, like really finding a sense of self-worth and recognizing when you need to stand up for yourself and recognize your own worth.
Mm-hmm.
But food does certainly play a key role in that. And there is a really beautiful passage in the beginning of the book, or towards the beginning of the book, that we'd love for you to read for us. Would that be okay?
I would love to read it. Some of my favorite moments on this book tour have been being able to read, so thanks for asking. We're going to just read a little bit, I think, from the beginning, from the first chapter. And there's a lot of discovery going on in this first chapter. So
yeah.
We'll read a little excerpt from there. When my career was at what most considered its pinnacle, early morning moments in the kitchen became necessary. I would thumb through recipes that I had spent the last decade writing. I would try to make time to look through at least one beautiful book by someone I loved and admired. I would play with fruit for as long as I could. After all the checklists were checked, deliveries were signed for, orders were placed, and schedules were written. Fruit was the first thing I would touch. Prepping and trimming and snacking while I had my coffee gave me a quiet moment and a memory recall that I needed. The methodical pace of tending to a few flats of strawberries or peaches or damson plums, my favorite, became the only time I still felt like a cook in my day-to-day life. A good piece of fruit, or several hundred good pieces of fruit, could inspire me to make a cold, frozen honey parfait, so light and so nearly something that felt just like honey air on your tongue, that it did not disrupt the fruit's pure ripeness. Or I'd rework my favorite pâte sucrée to have a beefiness that might carry the sometimes off-putting taste of a pawpaw, and experiment until learning that buckwheat or a toasted chestnut flour rounds out nicely that nearly mineral taste that those unusual and sometimes curiously disgusting fruits have. Fruit is titillating. Little pockets of juicy potential, full of an almost sexual promise of pleasure. It could make me change my mind and better my plans. The winter I first processed a few hundred pounds of apples, I spent the whole time dreaming of what they might become, my hands working faster and more efficiently with each step. Peeling and coring and dicing and settling the pieces in an ice-cold lemon water bath, feeling a kind of calmness, knowing I was in the right place, doing the right work. Those meditations sealed my fate as a pastry chef. Those moments became the ones I looked for when I found myself in a job that seemingly had very little to do with them.
So the feeling I have when I, certainly when I read that, and even more so when I hear you read it, is, this very intense connection that you feel when you're physically able to do the work of cooking and baking. And I mean, you write movingly about this in the book, but can you tell us about when you really discovered baking as a source of peace for you?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, I find such a sense of control in a kitchen. I think that so many people, especially women, are searching for in their early 20s and late teens. And, and in my particular experience, I was in, a somewhat tumultuous early adulthood. And so really finding a space where I was, able to make decisions and connect with a process became really important to me. I mean, it was also where I discovered that I am kind of by nature a creative maker and that I needed to be producing something useful in the world that had some sort of generosity and hospitality and even some beauty to it that I could offer, like a way to connect to other people. I could give that food away and I could, be a part of their experience, even if it was just by giving them a loaf of brioche, And I think so many people come to cooking for those reasons, to find a safe place to offer yourself to other people, I think is a really important aspect of cooking, and not all of us are as good as other people at putting ourselves in intimate relationships. And so, I think that's a tool for a lot of people to be able to make something special and beautiful and give it to another human to sustain themselves with. It's a really important part of what cooking is for me.
Yeah. And you talk about two things, right? One is the process and connecting yourself to the physical act of making, and the other is the giving, right? The hospitality, if you're doing it in a restaurant, or just like the sense of personal generosity, or just the sense of being able to give or provide to someone.
Yeah.
And so you worked in restaurants for a long time, and that sort of process of creating and giving and hospitality is one part of the restaurant experience. And except for a lot of people, that's the motivating part of the experience of working in a restaurant. But even as you rose to be one of the most respected pastry chefs in the South and even in the country, you also write a lot about how, the restaurant world is damaging.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I think I started really finding it frustrating and curious that most of the people that I found myself cooking around came to it sort of with this idea of some, not all, you know, some people really did want to kind of come to it for other reasons, and they wanted to have, you know, celebrity careers, and that's fine. That just wasn't sort of what I was angling after. And for me, I just started to find this really curious, like, anomaly of taking these people who are coming to be really dedicated to this idea of hospitality, and how I just had to sort of watch that get exploited time and time again. In a restaurant, you can work an entire day, an entire 24-hour cycle, and still have more work to do. And so there's a real danger there of that dedication being exploited, and it does get exploited. Mm. And also, you know, it gets exploited for the kids that come out of culinary school who really have high ambitions and high objectives for their career, and they're willing to, you know, do all of these things for free because it makes them feel, you know, more dedicated than the cook standing next to them. And there's this competitive sort of idea of what kitchens are then all of a sudden. And it not only changes the culture within a kitchen, it, you know, it really makes a sustainable lifestyle and a healthy lifestyle not within any of those cooks' grips. You know, it's really hard for them to no one's there to show them how to balance hard work with taking care of themselves. And so I'm really excited that conversations are happening now around the country and the world, and this dedication to finding a way to build restaurants that is more responsible and more focused on not exploiting its workers is a really significant conversation. So it's time, and it's happening, you know, and I think in this moment we have a real opportunity. It's an incredibly heartbreaking moment, and, you know, to be watching restaurants struggle the way they are struggling. And, you know, so many of my best friends are in the trenches right now trying to sort of protect everything they've built. And these are by and large people who have been dedicated to a bottom line that promotes and creates as best an opportunity for their workers as they possibly can. And so it's really hard to watch them struggle in this moment. And, you know, I reserve all judgment because I don't own a restaurant, and I, you know, I don't want to be an armchair critic, but, you know, I'm sitting here clinging to this hopeful silver lining that maybe this is the moment where we get to sort of watch that infrastructure finally, you know, collapse, and we rebuild it the way that we know it can be built. You know, and I still think there are going to be major hurdles and obstacles because our culture sort of struggles with, you know, healthcare and understanding the importance of paternity and maternity leave and daycare, you know, systems. And so I think we have much bigger conversations to have outside of just the restaurant industry about what we need culturally. So I think it starts to become an infrastructure conversation about the world that restaurants exist in the United States.
Right. You know. It's like we can blame the restaurants, we can blame the operators, but a lot of it is bigger than that. It's a society in which they exist.
Right.
And it's
the
ecosystem in which they exist. And you've been at a restaurant for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Do you miss it at all? I mean, even accepting the craziness of the current situation.
Yeah, well, there are parts of it I will always miss. You know, I miss the camaraderie. I miss the hard work. The hard physical labor is something that my body, you know, I was a dancer before I was ever in kitchens. And, you know, I do a lot of sitting around now as a writer. And I can feel like my body sort of really wanting to be exerted. And I will admit I am not dedicated to exercise for exercise sake. I've always been lucky to like have physical work. And, you know, so now I'm having to sort of replace that for my body, and that's not the easiest thing to do at 42 years old. But and I miss the people, and I do miss the, you know, it's a culture unlike anything else as the world is discovered, and there are beautiful parts to that. I can't think of another place where you can go and listen to, you know, loud music and joke around and cook food all day and be in a space that, you know, sometimes just feels like a dream come true, and then other times feels like the worst, you know, experience of your life. You know, it's a pretty
sometimes in the same shift.
Exactly. And sometimes in the same hour, you know. I mean, so it's definitely I miss the essential and core version of a restaurant job, getting to cook in a space. But, you know, I can remember the first time I left restaurants and swore I was never going back. I said to my husband, I said, you know, I love the work. I just can't afford this lifestyle. Lifestyle is too hard on a person. Mostly I am, to be really fair, completely relieved. So.
Lisa Donovan's book is Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger. Stick around because we're going to put her to work answering your baking questions. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We've been talking to Lisa Donovan, Southern baker extraordinaire, and author of the powerful memoir, Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger. We're taking your questions, and if you have cooking questions you want us to tackle on the show, record them as a voice memo on your phone. Email them, contact@splendidtable.org. We've got a great show on cooking with kids coming up, another one on Chinese food. Just send along anything you want to talk about. And now, let's get to your questions with Lisa. All right, we're going to go actually really far to the other side of the world. We're going to take a call from Fiona.
Hi, my name's Fiona, and I'm calling from Sydney, Australia. I love your show. Now, my question is about apples. My kids love apples, but frequently we have too many apples, apples that they won't eat because they're a bit mushy, a bit pasted, a bit floury. Oui. Now, I do make an apple crumble, but there's only so many apple crumbles one family can eat. So I'm just wanting to know what you can tell me about using up slightly overripe apples. Thanks so much.
Lisa, I know how much you love fruit, but man, a mealy apple really bums me out. Like...
Me too. But I will tell you, that's a really great question. And I feel like a lot of people don't know what to do with a mealy apple, which is unfortunate because you can do so much with a mealy apple. You can,
really?
I mean, even when I was not a professional cook, I would take mealy apples and just cook it down with just a little bit of sugar. I was trying to not give my kid too much sugar and just cook it down and let it sort of release its natural fruits. And then you can freeze it into little like ice cube trays and pop it out, let it come to room temperature. And all of a sudden you've got a little treat for a kid. You can make applesauce. You can make fruit leather. If it's really broken down, you can add pectin and you can really kind of help it create this fruit leather or patafouille. That's what I would do. I would just take them and, you know, make a little bit of apple leather. It's delicious and it holds for a while and you've got a nice little treat for your kids that they can take to school.
Do you have like the 1 minute version of how, like walk us through how you make an apple leather?
So I would look up like a patafouille recipe, which is basically a little like candy gelée. And I know there are some recipes out there that help you manage the sugar content and you can kind of up the pectin. But basically it's just a system of like cooking down the fruit and then really like slow, for the fruit leather in particular, you can just like kind of put it on a silpat and put it in a low oven and let it, kind of dehydrate into this really nice, chewy candy leather. You know, it's like a fruit roll up.
Oh, cool.
And it takes some time, but it's not a lot of involved work. You can cook them down and then kind of let it hang out in the oven. So you're mostly removed from the process. So it just takes sort of a watchful eye mostly.
Right on. Cool. Let's move on to Marie. And before we get to Marie, I should tell you, if you hear beeping on my side, it's because I literally live next to a construction zone now. So
how funny.
I keep hearing it. But okay, let's go to the call from Marie.
Okay, great.
This is Marie from St. Paul. My question is about how long to preheat an oven. Some recipes call to preheat for a long time before baking. For instance, a pizza recipe might say, preheat the oven for an hour. Mm. Once the oven reaches the set temperature, what difference does it make if it's preheated for 5 minutes versus being preheated for an hour? Isn't the temperature 500 degrees either way? It seems wasteful to me to heat an oven for an hour if you don't need to.
Yeah, for sure. And the other thing is, I have been so miserly about using the oven. Like, it's been so hot this summer.
With the heat, I know.
And yeah, like, to preheat, I'm like, once I get the temp, like, the food is going in there. But, like, why?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, why do you see that in recipes?
You know, I suspect that, you know, she mentions pizza. And I'm suspecting the only reason I can see my way to preheating for that long is if you're trying to thoroughly heat up a pizza stone. So
okay,
I'm
sure.
curious if that was sort of the suggestion for really heating a pizza stone. Because a pizza stone does need to sit in a pretty high heat to really make sure it is, like, absorbed the heat the way that that crust would need it to do what a pizza stone is meant to do. I don't even know that it needs an hour necessarily. Because I agree with her. I think once you get up to temp, if you have a fairly reason, you know, if your oven is calibrated and you know that it's running at the right temp, once it gets to temp, you're at temp. Now, when we're talking about baking, I am a big fan, and this is a little bit of a sidetrack, but I think it's important to note that if you know you need a really hot oven, like, for instance, pie baking is really important to have an extremely hot oven, there's no harm in preheating higher than you need and pulling it down when you enter the baked good. So, for instance, I know that I really want my pie crust. I bake all of my pie crusts from frozen with the filling. And I...
Really?
Yeah, because you want that cold and then you want that extreme hot. And you really want your butter to react really rapidly to the heat, and kind of that's what creates that really beautiful flake. If you can really introduce that sort of extreme...
like shocking it almost.
Yeah, you're shocking your butter basically into the flour. And so all that work you did to work your butter into your flour can further get worked in that moment when you put a really cold pie crust into a really hot oven. So I bake my pie, depending on the kind of pie, typically between 375 and 425, but I always preheat my oven to 500 and I let it sit there until I'm ready with the filling, and then I pop it in and turn it right down. So, you know, you have to kind of, you have to kind of practice and think about these things a little bit based on what you need. But that's always how I do it. And I do the same with my biscuits because I really want that reaction to happen. And then I turn it down so that it can then bake. So there's a whole lot of conversations to have about how hot your oven needs to be and what, you know, preheating does and doesn't do. But specifically to her question, I suspect that pizza recipe included a pizza stone, and that's why it required more time, because a pizza stone does need more time to heat up.
Sure. Okay, I can't let go of the pie.
I love talking about pie.
And everyone at home should listen to it, because Lisa makes truly the greatest pie and truly the greatest biscuits I've ever had. So this is really important. So what you're saying is you make your pie crust, you set it in the pie plate,
right?
You freeze it.
That's right.
You take it out, you fill it while it's frozen, and then you bake it.
That's right. Okay. And I put it into a... You know, I mean, like, there's a whole list of conversations we could have surrounding, like, what butter needs to do when it's introduced to flour and what flour's job is with the butter. And, you know, people so oftentimes say, like, oh, I've, you know, my pie crust is chewy because I overworked my butter, but I don't think they really understand what that means. And so what you're doing is you're basically just trying to control the variables of how much hydration gets released into your flour, which sounds really sciencey, but it's really not. If you kind of back up a little bit and think about how butter is made, you make butter by beating the water out of cream, right? So if you can kind of think about logistically what it means when you say I've overworked my butter, it means that you've created an environment where your flour is pulling more water out of the butter than it should, and flour's job is to absorb hydration. And this is why I think Southern bakers are so good at what they do, because what is it in the South? It's usually 100% humidity, especially right now. So our flour can sit in a bowl on our kitchen counter and absorb humidity. I mean, that is what flowers' job is. It's to absorb humidity, and it will always absorb what is around it. And so it can change just by sitting in a really humid kitchen. So what you really want to do is avoid letting that butter create more hydration into the flour. So you're essentially, that's why it always says use really cold butter, right? Because what you really want to do is quickly
lock the water in the butter.
Yes, you want to keep that water in the butter. And so by default, if you kind of can get that pie dough made, put it into the pie tin, freeze it, you're then continuing to help the butter hold on to its water. And then if you then go to the next step and pop it into a really hot oven, basically you're creating a reaction where the water doesn't sog into the flour. It actually kind of steams out. Mm-hmm. And all you're getting is this real beautiful pure butter flake into the flour. In certain measures, of course, the water will get into the flour, but not quite the way it would if your oven was at 375 and you put that pie dough in. Think about how much that butter is going to be just sort of sogging into your flour, right?
Yeah,
instead of like, boom, hot, hot, and then it just moves into the flour and creates this really beautiful reaction. All of the pie workshops that I've done, I always get too scared to make it sound too sciencey because I think it intimidates people. But if you just take it all the way back to like the basic tenets of flour and butter, it's really simple. You know, it's really simple. So I could talk about pie forever, literally. So.
All right. So thank you, Marie in St. Paul, for a simple question about preheating. It turned into a masterclass in pie dough making. Okay, let's go to Shane.
This is Shane in Houston, and I'm sorry to say that I'm having trouble seasoning my cast iron skillet. I leave it in the oven at 500 degrees for at least an hour with a thin layer of oil over it, and it comes out black and shiny and beautiful.
Yeah.
The problem is that after I use it, like for roasting fajita veggies, when I wash it, the seasoning layer starts to peel immediately. Hmm. I've put on multiple layers, and it still has this problem. What am I doing wrong? Thanks, y'all.
Speaking of leaving the oven on for a really long time.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the problem. That's a great question. And I know a lot of people have issues and kind of, to be frank, like overcomplicate the cast iron skillet situation, I think. I think, you know,
kind
maybe it's
way too.
Yeah, I feel like it's a little easier than people might think. So I think one of the first mistakes you might be making, Shane, is your oven might be too hot and you're doing it for too long. I think maybe try like a lesser version of seasoning, like to an extreme. So basically what I do is I'll cook with it and I actually wash my cast iron with water, sometimes soap, depending on what I've used it for. And I just recoat it with a nice little thin layer of whatever fat I have around. And I put it in a warm oven. So, you know, with any luck, I've cooked something in the oven and the oven is still, you know, 300 degrees working its way down. And I try to get my cast iron washed and recoated. And I just put it in an oven that's turned off and cooling. I'm not sure that you need an extreme heat, especially if you're using it regularly. That's part of the equation too, is using a cast iron skillet as regularly as possible. Mm-hmm. I use it basically for everything. And so it's easier for me to sort of like, you know, just rub a little oil on it, stick it in a hot oven that's turned off and cooling. And I think that kind of helps it become more of a routine than like a 500 degree oven for a long time, because what you're going to get is like a burned oil, I think, on top of your cast iron that is more residue than seasoning the iron, right? So I think the problem is that you're actually creating a layer that's not technically seasoning. I think what you really need to think of it is more of like you're trying to saturate that cast iron. You're not trying to create a layer on top of it so much. Does that, you know, and some people might disagree with that, but that's how I treat my cast irons. And they, you know, I barely have to use, you know, oil to cook. Sometimes I can fry an egg on it and it comes out pretty decent, you know. And if some of the seasoning has sort of faded, I just really try to kind of give it a little extra attention for a couple of days.
Yeah. I have to admit, I used to be also a little bit like obsessive in the sense of, you know, what's the best technique? What's the best oil to mm-hmm. use? Do you use like rice bran oil only for your seasoning and da-da-da-da-da-da-da? And yeah, I mean, I definitely have a situation where I seasoned, it wasn't cast iron, but whatever, it was like a blue steel pan. I seasoned it really well. Like Shane was talking about, using a very specific technique. I don't think it was 500, it was like 350. And it started to become really pretty beautiful. And then for whatever reason, the seasoning layer did start to chip off. And I haven't touched that pan now in like 4 years, because every time I look at it, my heart just hurts. And then I can't even bring myself to think about having to do it again. And then, like, you know, and then in the beginning of like quarantine, I bought myself a plain old like 9-inch cast iron skillet. And instead of being obsessive with it, I just, like you said, I just cooked with it a lot. And I try not to do the stereotypical cast iron things, where people always want to sear really hard in cast iron, because mm-hmm. it's great for that.
Yeah.
But I tried not to do that for the first, you know, little while.
Oh, interesting.
Because I was just nervous about, like, if you're searing too much stuff, then you're getting mm-hmm. Like caramelized sugars mm-hmm. seared onto it that you don't mm-hmm. want to scrub off or whatever. So I was just like That's cooking smart. At like nice moderate heats and pan frying and, mm-hmm. and like doing bacon in it and doing stuff like that, was getting it nice and greasy is just part of the thing.
Yeah.
And then eventually I was just like cooking enough with it where I just kind of felt like, even after I washed it, and I do actually wash it with soap. Mm-hmm. I think it's a myth to say you can't wash it with soap, because the seasoning layer has bonded to the metal. It's not grease. So after a while cooking with it, even when I wash it with soap, I would still see that mm-hmm. there was still nice slickness to it. And I was like, oh, I think it is just seasoning itself after a while.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's about use. And I also think people underestimate the ability to bake in a cast iron skillet. And I don't even mean like baked goods per se, but, you know, like sticking a cast iron skillet in an oven with a piece of roasted chicken is a great way to season mm-hmm. it, you know, mm-hmm. because it's doing this really slow, you know, release of fat, and that's going to really help you season your, you know, your skillet, because it's just by nature, that's what seasoning a skillet does. So if you're looking for sort of some angles to making a cast iron skillet a little bit, you know, richer in its seasoning, without actually going through all the effort of I'm oiling it and ovening it and I'm doing all these things, just bake a few, you know, chicken thighs, you know, at, you know, 375, because chicken thighs take, you know, about 20 minutes to cook, 25 minutes, you know, and that's a half an hour.
You get dinner out of it too.
Yeah. And then you can even turn your oven off and keep all of that chicken fat in there and just let it sit with that chicken fat in a warm oven for while you eat dinner, you know, and kind of give it those experiences. Don't be so quick to, like, you know, move the fat out of it, you know, just kind of let it sit with that, because that's the best way to enrichen your cast iron experiences, is to just sort of give it these opportunities to hang out with fat in a real nice, authentic way. And then every once in a while, if like you feel like you want to rub some oil on it, put it in an oven and try to like really seal it in, that's your prerogative. But I think there's more to how you're cooking with it that's going to help you season it than
I love how you're putting it, like, you've got to let your cast iron have some experience with the fat. Just let it hang out with the fat. I love that. It's like, put it in the fat spa. That's what you're trying to do. Don't, like, bake in an oven for 500 degrees for an hour. That's not a spa. That's just torture.
Exactly.
Lisa Donovan's memoir is titled Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger. It's a great title. We'll be back with more with her in a minute, and we'll talk sweets with one of the great explorers of Middle Eastern cooking, Anissa Helou. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking about baking with Lisa Donovan, one of the greatest bakers I know, and she's the author of the memoir, Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger. Let's get back to your questions. All right, let's move on to Heather. Heather's got a great question.
Hey, Frances. This is Heather calling from Chicago. Recently, I acquired quite a bit of rye flour, almost 7 pounds, ordered on accident.
Oh, wow.
While I do use it to feed my sourdough starter and to make bread, still quite a bit I have on my hands. So yeah. I'm wondering if you have any recipes or ideas of other baked goods and things I could make with rye flour. Mm. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Oh, I love rye flour. I love rye flour. And I love any kind of variety of flour that has that a potential to taste. You know, I'm never like a fan of that. Well, I do love a weedy taste, but I love like a nutty taste in a flour, you know, like an interesting sort of curious taste to a flour, and things like chestnut flour and rye flour and buckwheat flour and all of those kinds of flours are so good, believe it or not, to make like shortbread with. They just add such an interesting little, like, you don't have to add much, and it's not going to really, you know, massively chip away at your 7 pounds of dry flour, but it'll help you kind of move, you know, closer to having a reasonable amount as opposed to, you know, a restaurant volume amount. But I love, you know, I love getting a little bit of rye flour and just lightly toasting it in a skillet and tossing. You know, you can use about 25% of your recipe. So say you have a shortbread recipe or a biscuit recipe or a scone recipe. I would take a little bit of your rye flour and I would just toast it. I think it's so important to let those flours spend a little bit of time on just a real soft heat, and you'll smell how much more they open up, and they're going to add so much of a richer flavor to your cookie or scone or biscuit or even a quick loaf of some sort. They just add a little corner of curiosity to the taste, and I think that's really, really special whenever you're doing, especially something that's a little sweet. So I would just take, like, say you've got a shortbread recipe. My shortbread recipe, I think, is 1 pound of butter, 1 cup of sugar, and 4 cups of flour. So I think what I would do is probably take out about 1/2 cup of that, or maybe a little more. I would start with 1/2 cup, and then I'd probably push it on the next trial run and just toast it a little bit and introduce 1/2 cup of that rye flour into the base recipe for whatever recipe you're using, and just see where it goes. And you might find that you want more. You might find that you want less. You might find that you want it, your shortbread or your scone or your biscuit to be a little more tender or a little less grainy. And then you can adjust from there. And this is one of the most fun things I think people miss about baking is, as long as you're kind of keeping some notes for yourself. And I'm not saying that everyone has to have 5,000 notebooks in their kitchen like I do, but I like to keep little notes to myself of like what I tried and if it worked. And I think when you have something like 7 pounds of rye flour, it's a great opportunity to experiment and to play around and see where those kinds of things might be. But I love putting, you know, these savory flours into any kind of sweet thing. I think it would be delicious in a banana bread, just a little bit.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Right?
Yeah. And again, your really guide is swap out like maybe like 1/8 to 1/4 of the flour, of like wheat flour with the rye flour, and try it out first and see where you go.
Yeah, cool. I would start small and work your way up.
Well, thank you, Lisa, for joining us today.
It was so fun, Frances. I love talking with you.
It always feels so like so warm and inviting to talk with you, and it just feels like maybe things can be okay in the world.
Well, if that's all it takes.
Right, Lisa, well, congratulations again on the book.
Thank
I hope you,
you
enjoy
Frances.
Talking about it
Thank
over you. And over and over again.
I do still. It hasn't worn off yet, and it's really especially nice to talk about it with friends, so thanks for having me.
That's a pleasure. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Thanks, Frances.
Lisa Donovan is the author of Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger. She left us with a recipe for one of her amazing pies. Trust me, I've tasted it. It's incredible. Find her chocolate chess pie recipe and her pie crust at splendidtable.org. For decades, Anissa Helou traveled the Middle East studying and dealing in art, building a serious reputation for herself as an expert in the region. But one night, at a dinner party in London in the 90s, her friends talked with her about how it was so hard to find any Lebanese cookbooks. So she grew up in Beirut, and in that moment she realized that there were whole generations of Lebanese abroad who were disconnected, you know, from the food of their homeland because of the civil war. So she went and wrote that cookbook and changed her career to write 8 more. Her latest is called Feast, Food of the Islamic World. But we're excited to have her in to talk about the research that led her to her previous book called Sweet Middle East. Hi, Anissa. It's so great to have you.
Hi, Francis. Lovely to be on with you.
Oh, thank you. So I want to start with baklava, because who doesn't love baklava? So Anissa, I'm going to ask you to do a little bit of a mental exercise, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Close your eyes and remember the best baklava maker you've ever seen. Where are you and what do you see them doing?
Well, the best ever baklava I've ever had is in Damascus at a place called Sidi Hamid's Rose Damas. But unfortunately, they never let me into the kitchen because they were very protective of their, you know, technique, secrets, whatever.
Okay.
But where I have been in the kitchen, I have been in Turkey, in Istanbul, in Gaziantep, and also in Aleppo. And in Turkey, they were still rolling out the pilo by hand, whereas in Aleppo, they were doing it by machine. And both were absolutely fascinating. So the most, like, magical place was in the southeast, in Gaziantep, where they had a special rolling room. But that whole room was shrouded in a cloud of cornstarch, because they have to use cornstarch to roll out the dough.
Uh-huh.
And there was quite a few men, long tables, because they roll out huge sheets of dough, with very long, thin rolling pins. And they were rolling these amazing paper-thin sheets of dough that they were also flapping as they were kind of unrolling them and then rolling them again. Incredible technique and incredible skill.
Yeah.
And the machine rolling was a kind of very large machine where they had stacks of sheets of dough that were quite thick to start with a lot of cornstarch in between. And, you know, the rolling pin was automated and it would go back and forth. And each time the men would turn the circles of dough so that they would be, you know, quite even.
Mm-hmm,
and then it would flatten to, I don't know, a meter wide or more. So it was quite fascinating in both techniques.
Yeah. How do they bake that dough once it's so thin? I've actually never seen that done before.
Because they layer it.
How's it cooked?
Well, what happens once they have these sheets of dough, they, I think if I'm not mistaken, they have more than one sheet on the rolling pin at the end, or maybe just one. And then they unroll them over trays and they make layers. They, I don't know, 6, 8, 10, 12 layers. Then they spread the nut filling over these many layers and then more layers. Then they cut them to the shape they want, which is either diamonds or squares or, you know, rectangles or whatever. And then they sprinkle ghee or melted butter over. And in this particular place in Gaziantep, it was a wood-fired oven. And the most fascinating thing is when they take out the baked baklava, which is kind of golden and beautiful, they put it on gas burners, and then they pour very hot syrup over it. And then the top layers of filo, they kind of dance. They call it dancing baklava because they kind of bob up and down.
Oh, cool.
You know, the reaction with the hot syrup. And you're watching all this, and you're thinking, oh, my God, I want to eat it immediately.
Oh, God, because the layers are so thin and so crisp. It's just baked, so like the pistachios are still hot, and then the hot syrup hits it and all, it just kind of makes it dance and bubble. That's such an incredible craft. There was something in your book that I read with some interest. You said that, you know, you've always felt welcome you know, in restaurants, restaurant cooks have always let you come in to see what they're doing, even just as a civilian before you, you know, told them you were a writer and all that. But that the kitchens of sweets makers in your journeys through the Middle East tended to be a little more off limits. And like you said, the very best baklava you've ever had was in Damascus, and they wouldn't let you in that kitchen at all. Do you have a sense of why there's a secrecy around this craft and not?
They're all very possessive of their craft and of their secrets. I mean, it's not that there is that much difference in the, let's say, basic recipe, but in the quality of the phyllo or the quality of the nuts or the, you know, balance, so much syrup or not enough syrup or whatever, and the baking and the quality of the ghee. You know, the best sweets maker in Lebanon uses sheep's milk ghee that he imports from France.
Oh, wow.
So the quality of the ingredients and the, let's say, the balance, or how many sheets per kilo, how much filling. So that's basically what differentiates the good sweets makers from others, and the ones who are top definitely don't want to share their secrets.
Yeah. Okay, so I don't have any experience in making any kind of Arab pastry, in large part because I feel like I was always just told that, you know, they're really best left to the professionals. And there's a shop here in New York, in Queens, that, for instance, is known for being the only place in the whole city that makes Palestinian kanefa, which is like this sort of crispy pie filled with melty, syrupy cheese. And it's amazing. And I tasted it and I'm like, okay, I guess it's actually made of magic. What are some sweets, some Arab sweets that you feel should be more appreciated, that maybe people not in, from these cultures might not know about?
Yeah, I think there are lots. I mean, to start with the mamoul, which is a typical celebration sweet for Easter with the Christians and for Ramadan and Eid for the Muslims. It's a baby. Mm-hmm. It's basically, I call it cookie, but it's not really cookie. It's like a crumbly pastry that is filled with nuts, either walnuts or pistachios, sometimes almonds, but not so much, or date paste. And they're molded in beautiful wooden molds. And the art in making these is to have an even layer all around the filling, and not to have the pastry overflow from the mold so that you have perfect shapes. And these are very much homemade. And in fact, they're better made at home than at the commercial sweet makers. And they deserve to be better known because they're kind of also quite close to Western biscuits, cookies, that kind of sweet pastries. Or one of my favorites is the Moroccan Gomba Gazelle, which is basically a crescent made with almond paste, flavored with orange blossom water, and wrapped in the thinnest pastry you can think of. And that they make at home. You know, they roll it out. The women, they specialize in it. And it's baked very lightly golden. And it's just with minty, Moroccan minty, it's one of the best things ever.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned almond paste in the Comte de Gazelle, and it makes me think about the fact that you live in Sicily now.
Yeah.
Which, you know, most people in the U.S. know of as part of Italy, but which has hundreds of years of Arab history. And the Sicilians have a huge tradition of sweets on their own, many of which involve almond paste. Do you see the Arab influence on the sweets there, and then how that influence traveled to other parts of Europe?
Well, I think the use of almonds is Arab influence, but also the sugar. The Arabs brought the sugar to Sicily in the 7th century, I think, or a bit later.
Like the literally just using sugar is an Arab influence.
Yeah. I mean, the Crusaders brought back the sugar into Europe, and you know, in the 12th century. But the Arabs, when they enlarged their empires, they took the sugar with them from Iran to other places.
It's amazing. Thank you so much, Anissa. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you, Francis. It was great talking to you.
Anissa Helou is the author of Feast, Food of the Islamic World, and many other books, including Sweet Middle East. And she left us with a classic recipe for a Lebanese sweet cheese pie called kanifa. It's beautiful, delicious, and really pretty easy to make. Find it at splendidtable.org. That's our show for the week. Keep sending us your questions. We've got a great show coming up about cooking with kids with our friend Kenji Lopez-Alt. We've got another one on Chinese and Chinese-American cooking, so get in touch. It's simple. Record a question or comment on voice memo on your phone and email it to contact@splendidtable.org. Thanks for listening, as always. Take care, wear your mask, and be safe. Talk to you next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and is supported by you. Thanks to everyone who chooses to help out their public radio station in these pretty weird times. You make a world of difference, and we thank you seriously. You can listen to all of our podcasts, find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to get them, and sign up for our weekly email. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It delivers a recipe straight to your inbox every Wednesday to make dinner time a little easier. Sign up at splendidtable.org. Stay safe. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.